Just a note before we start. Our show talks about touchy subjects that may be difficult for some of our listeners. Take care of yourself. If you feel you need to seek help, see the links at the end of our show notes for resources.
Welcome to Touchy Subjects, the podcast that aims to make those awkward conversations around domestic and sexual violence just a little less awkward. I'm Sean.
And I'm Amanda.
And today, we have a special guest for our listeners. We have invited John Krotek here to discuss his own story. So, John, please feel free to introduce yourself, and thank you for being here.
Hey, absolutely. Thank you very much, Amanda and Sean. It's great to be here, and my name is John Krotek, like Sean just said, and I'm here to talk about touchy subjects and subjects that don't need to be so touchy. And I find that the more we talk about them, the better it gets. Well, actually, the better it gets. I don't know if that's really true. It just gets different. I'm a typical American kid. You know, I grew up in Florida on the West Coast. I came from a middle class family, two older sisters and a younger brother. I was the Cub Scout, the Boy Scout, the kid interested in models and sports. My dad worked an awful lot. My mom raised all of us kids. And I guess, you know, we can jump into this right away. No reason to beat around the bush. But I was on a sleepover in the third grade. And just a bunch of guys, right? There were some older kids there. And I was just about in that twilight where you're just about ready to fall asleep. We had been up, you know, cracking jokes and doing what boys do. And immediately I knew something wasn't right. And there was a much larger kid. You know, here I am, you know, over 40 years later, I can remember it pretty distinctly. On top of me and inside of me, almost like within seconds. And I froze, and it was very animalistic. It was very intense. What I remember the most, though, it lasted all about maybe, you know, 80 seconds, 90 seconds, a minute and a half. And after he had finished what he was doing, he was about 120 pounds. I was maybe 70 pounds. He literally passed out on top of me. And I remember being trapped, and I remember looking to my right, and his face was right next to mine. He had passed out, and he was foaming at the mouth. It was horrific, really, when I think about it now, and I try not to. But so anyhow, I got him off of me, and I kind of just slid down and sat by the corner of the bed. And then he came to, and was probably really not even a minute that he was out. And immediately he apologized for what happened, and said he was sorry, and said that there wasn't any use to tell anybody because they would never believe it, or that somehow I would be responsible. So here I was, you know, third grade kid that summer, you know, heading into fourth grade. He was about 2 years ahead. He was an older kid, and come to find out later that he was a foster child who had been in and out of foster homes. I don't know if that had anything to do with what he did, but what he did I knew was wrong. But I told nobody about it. I mean, I literally told nobody about it. And on one of the covers of my book, you can see a third grader on one side. You can see the eyes of that child. I remember that kid. And then on the other side of the book is a portrait of me that following year in the fourth grade. And it's night and day. What's interesting is nobody really picked up on the signs. You all know probably what the signs are, but nobody really picked up on it. And somehow I even knew at that age that to even say anything about it, somehow it was either going to be my fault, which is what I believe, somehow I would be blamed, but even more so, I would forever be labeled that kid. There's that kid, you know, that, you know, I just imagine Snickers and all kinds of things being said. So sad part of that was all through, you know, junior high school, we finished out elementary, and all through junior high school and high school, I'd see this kid all the time. And it was like this unspoken, just nasty memory. And there were many times I just wanted to just strangle the guy. But, you know, you just go about your life and you shelf it, you compartmentalize it. But it really did cause a lot of issues for a long, long time in my life. This feeling of always trying to prove my masculinity. When I got into college, you know, it was about, you know, intimacy scared me because I always thought I was going to have to level with somebody and tell them what happened. So there was natural use of alcohol to deaden really the pain. And then it was never hard for me to attract a girl, you know, and then, but I was the guy that, you know, you attract a girl, you get real close. Sometimes things would happen and then I'd be gone. So, you know, probably the early fallout of that event was I broke some hearts that didn't deserve to be broken. And I'm sure a lot of it had to do with the fear of intimacy, but more than anything, the fear of not being a man, you know, because something like that happens to you, it stings to your core, and things aren't supposed to happen like that to guys. You know, we're supposed to be able to defend ourselves and all of these things, and I just couldn't. So somewhere in that mind was a feeling of weakness, inadequacy. What are people thinking of me? You know, I never really liked the conversations that guys had, you know, homophobic conversations and what they did to this girl or what they did to that girl. And I never really liked any of those kinds of conversations. But, you know, to fit in, I probably drank more than I should have. And what would happen throughout my adult life is I would always somehow find a way. I was very successful in anything I ever did, was always pretty much an overachiever. But I'd always get to a point, and then what would happen is I would overspend, or I would drink too much at a party and embarrass myself, on and off throughout my adult life. But I did a great job of compartmentalizing it. And, you know, the reputation that I had was a guy full of energy, a guy that you could trust to get the job done. And I always had an easy time of making friends. I had an empathy and a compassion for people that that helped me with these relationships. So all of this, you know, my life went on. I was successful. I ended up getting married. I served my country in the Army, successful there. My wife and I ran a small business for 23 years. And so, you know, I had two stepkids. We sent those kids away to college. And in 2012, my wife had just left to go to Virginia. And my best friend from work, his wife had left to go back to Peru. And it was raining that night. And he called me at my house and he was like, "Hey, you want to go out tonight and shoot pool?" And I was like, "No, you know, it's 9 o'clock. What are you calling me now for?" Of course, 9 o'clock is early, you know, for an older guy. So finally, I'm like, "You know what?" I told him, I said, "Well, I'll go out, but I'm not staying out late. I want to be home before midnight." And he's like, "Sure, okay." So we go out, we shoot a couple games of pool. We're upstairs at this local club in Sarasota, which is a very nice community down in Florida. And had a couple of glasses of wine. And then I looked at my watch and I said, "You know, heck, it's 10:45. Want to get going." And so we did the chest bump thing. He went out the front door. I went out the side door. And the next thing you know, I wake up in an automobile accident. I had literally passed out at the wheel on two glasses of wine. There was something else in there that we later found out. But I had a head injury. And it wasn't just a typical bump on the head. It's what they call traumatic brain injury. So they couldn't do anything at the scene. They had to take me to the hospital that night. And I spent the night in hospital and woke up the next morning with a hellacious headache. And everything was intact. And I called my buddy to come pick me up. And he's like, "No way, you know, you got in this accident." So the details of the accident don't matter. But what really started to happen was, like, immediately with a traumatic brain injury, it changes you physically and mentally. And what happened, I immediately had these mood swings. of anger and resentment. I was getting no sleep, called my wife, told her I'd been in an accident, and they gave me a ticket for reckless driving is what they gave me a ticket for. Well, unbeknownst to me, they had drawn blood at the hospital because they couldn't give me a field sobriety test because a head injury has the same symptoms as a DUI. So 2 months later, I'm at my home having dinner, my wife, and two police cars pull up, sheriff's deputies pull up to my house, and they come into our house and they arrest me 8 weeks after the accident and for driving under the influence. It was a nightmare. There was a $25,000 bond, which was insane. And anyhow, so I went through the process, saw how that worked. But while all that was going on, I was having difficulties with mood swings that were just off the charts. They scared me. Eventually, what happened is I ended up moving out of the bedroom that I had slept with my wife for 20 years. And moved into another bedroom. I'd find myself up at 3 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, 1 o'clock in the morning, pacing and just angry and angsty and not really understanding why. Obviously the traumatic brain injury, but so things started to erode. My relationship with my wife started to erode. My relationship with my business started to erode. Friends were wondering what was wrong with me. And there was a slow erosion of my life. And so it wasn't long after that that my wife decided she no longer wanted to be my business partner. And I don't blame her. I put that woman through the ringer. There was nothing physical. It was all emotional and verbal stuff. And so it forced the sale of our business, which I didn't say anything to anybody at the time, but it crushed me personally because that business was my identity. It was a backpacking store, and it was the things that I enjoyed doing, and it was successful. So it wasn't long after that that I found myself embroiled in the divorce, and probably rightfully so, looking back on it now. Why would any person want to stay with somebody that was off the charts and just spending money like a drunken sailor? It was absolute insanity. And so the universe, as it always does, call it God, call it karma, call it whatever you will, intervened. And my mother-in-law, we were down in Florida at the time, my mother-in-law who lived in Virginia, at 91 years old, slipped and fell and broke her shoulder and hip. And my wife had to leave, separate from me in Florida and go to Virginia to take care of her mom. And so that was October 31st of 2015. So I'm sitting in the house. My wife's gone. I'm all alone. The kids are, graduated from school and out doing their own thing. And I finally realized, a good friend of mine said, what are you doing, John? You're 52, 53 years old. Do you really want to start over? What is wrong with you? You got a great wife. You can work out whatever's going on. So I thought to myself, he's right. What am I doing? So I waited a couple of months. My wife was still in Virginia. I drove all the way to the Richmond area the day before Christmas, spent the night at a hotel. And on Christmas morning, I knocked on the door to my wife's home. And she answers the door. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning, maybe a couple minutes earlier than that. And she's like, what are you doing here? I was so off the chart. She was actually scared. She didn't tell me at the time, but she was scared that I had driven all the way up there. And she basically said, John, I don't have time for this. It's over. You need to start getting your life together. So I got in my truck. I drove all the way back down to Jacksonville, Florida, and spent the night at a Holiday Inn Express. This is Christmas Day. I literally had no sleep that night. The next morning, as I was leaving, it was only the lady that worked in the restaurant and the hotel and me. And I was not feeling right. There was something emotionally wrong with me. And I got on the highway, Interstate 10. It connects up to I-75. And when I got to I-75, I was starting to contemplate not wanting to be here. And I was thinking of things that I could do to end my own life. I mean, real serious freaking thoughts. And it scared me. And I'd never thought anything like that in my entire life. And so I called a crisis hotline in Orlando. And the person at the other end of the phone, these are professionals, by the way, young lady started to talk to me. And she basically said, pretty in short order, you know, we can't save your marriage, but we can save you. And after about 45 minutes of keeping me on the phone, she managed quite skillfully to calm me down, talk me off the ledge. She made me feel important. But probably more importantly, she gave me the information that I needed to get help for my emotional state, which was not good. Short time later, I found myself checked into a counseling center, you know, an outpatient one-on-one with an expert. In this case, it was cognitive behavioral therapy. And I sat down and began that personal journey. And again, early on, the therapist told me, again, Cheryl Andrews at CenterPoint down in Venice, Florida, great person, great program. She said, you know, John, we can't say your marriage, but we can save you, but it's going to take hard work. And it did. And within about 3 weeks, I went in for a session and she's smiling at me. And I'm like, what are you smiling at? She's like, I'm happy that you're doing the work. I can see that you're really making an effort to change yourself, to change your behaviors. Well, in the therapy, what came out was that 90-second episode that I had stuffed for over 40 years, and it just all came out. And what I learned was, and it's hard to decode a few things here. First of all, well, what I learned was it wasn't my fault. And then the second thing that I had to learn was that the way to get through this was I had to really appreciate who I was. Things like that affect your self-esteem at such a level, as you all know, and some listeners probably know, that you just feel like a piece of human trash. It's probably the best way to describe it. And so one of the things that they did was, Cheryl said, if you get up at night, you know, and turn on the lights, go into that mirror in the bathroom, and tell that person in the mirror how much you care about them and how much you love them, right? Well, my wife was out of town, so it was relatively easy. I wasn't used to doing things like that. So second or third night after our session, the 1 o'clock, I'm up, I go in there and I turn on the lights and I actually look around to see who's watching. Because, you know, who tells themselves that they love themselves? So I basically went out and said, hey, I love you, John. And that was it. Went back to bed. But this went on for a period of time. And then it got to the point to where I started having conversations with myself. You're a great guy, man. You are a great guy. People love you. And I started to build trust with myself. And I started to believe the things that I was saying to myself. And so that began the healing process. So 11 months later, the week before Thanksgiving, I get a card in the mail from my wife. And it basically went something like this. I want you to know, dear John, it wasn't the typical dear John letter. I want you to know that I called my attorney this morning and I've called off the divorce. And I've seen a big change in you. And I want to spend the rest of my life with you. Keep going. Love, Tommy. And I was like, I was alone in the bedroom, but it hit me like lightning. And I fell to my knees. And I literally cried like a baby because I had won back the love and the heart of a woman that I had literally treated like crap. And in fact, it was the first time in my life that I feel like I had earned something big. You know, we continue to work on the marriage. I continue to work on behavioral reactions to triggers. But, you know, I said that it's gotten better. It doesn't really get better. It just gets different. And so I saved my marriage. That was in 2016. And so since then, I've published two books, two poetry books, and I've started a couple of different projects to help people's businesses and their companies prosper. I'm working on my first TED Talk, as a matter of fact. I'm 62 now. And so it's been almost a 10-year journey to finally get back on track. And you know, it's never too late to turn things around if you're in those dark spots. But it takes commitment, it takes hard work, it takes a willingness, and it takes a team. You know, it takes a support network around you, family and friends and people that you really know, because the whole thing with sexual trauma, the assault, the rape, whatever you want to call it, and at such a young age, your wires get crossed. And I remember in therapy, you know, sex feels good, and there's these intense emotions, but not like that. And that's kind of what I think jumbles you up is you have these mixed concepts of how to implement sex and what it really means. And especially if it's, you know, male on, I guess any type of indiscretion like that is going to have some negative effect. Some people are more resilient than others. So I would like to say I've got over four decades of, practical experience in forgiveness and in resiliency and in love, because without those three things, it's going to be an even steeper uphill battle. So that's, you know, that's basically my story. It's not unlike probably hundreds of thousands, millions of people out there, you know, and the more I discuss it and the more I talk about it, professionals like you all, and even non-professionals, it reinforces the healing process. I found since then that I've talked to men and women who would come up and would say, you know, thank you for coming clean and telling us your story. By the way, you know, when I was in the ninth grade, my grandfather did this. Or a woman will tell me, you know, my brother did this. Or, you know, it really started to amaze me how many people out there that you pass every day on the street, maybe even some of these high-risk individuals, have a story to tell. And I think, 3 out of 5 girls by the time they're 18 have something to say, and maybe 1 or 2 boys have something to say. But it may even be just as equal with the boys, because the boys keep our mouths shut. And I believe that the perpetrators, especially the skilled ones, know that. There's a lot of hurt, broken people out there. And whoever's listening, it's not your fault. So that's my story. And there is light at the end of the tunnel, and you can take a dark subject and, you know, all the cliches that we hear, making lemonade out of lemons and all of these great things. Well, I wish it was that easy, but I just want people to know that these things happen. For the parents out there, keep an eye on your kids, because it happens, and it isn't easy to deal with it. At this stage of the game, I don't, you know, it would have been great to have had help like immediately. I can't even imagine how many hurt feelings and broken hearts that we could have stopped, and how many thousands of dollars, because of mistakes that I've made in my life, probably stem from that one incident, a 90-second incident. And I don't look at myself as a victim. I really look at myself as a naive kid that got taken advantage of. And I wonder about that guy. I've never looked him up, but I wonder what he endured in his life for him to want to do that to another kid. And especially a guy that I trusted. Remember the big T word, trust. You know, something like that blows your trust. You don't trust the world. You actually hate yourself. But that's part of the the details around stuff like that too, is it just blows your trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm sure you've heard it many times in your career, but I want to thank you, John, for being willing to share your story, because not only is your story powerful, but I am sure there's at least one person listening who can relate. Maybe not relate to this specific incident, but to the wanting to drink, the wanting to look for ways to kind of push it down or ignore it or just isolate it from their main train of thought, or just relate to the fact that they have similar experiences and their story of their healing journey sounds very similar. So I wanted to thank you for that, because not only is that validating for you, but that's going to be validating for anyone listening who shares those similar experiences.
Well, thank you for that. You know, you're right, Sean. You know, here I am, you know, when they're picking teams for kickball, you know, most kids are picking, you know, or thinking about who they want on their team. And you're thinking about, do they think something's wrong with me? Are they going to pick me? You know, what's up with that? And then I can remember writing a poem, I think it was 9th or 10th grade, Why I Hate Being a Guy. And I can remember it all this time later, was because guys do things to hurt people. And here I'm in the 9th grade thinking about stuff like that. Kids should be thinking about prom or homecoming or, you know, Boy Scout camporees or something like that. They shouldn't be thinking about deep emotional subjects like rape and sexual assault. It's just, that's too much for kids to, it's too much for anybody to, really.
Yeah. And one of the things that you mentioned in sharing your story that I want to point out and hit on a little bit too, you mentioned, so again, with that poem titled Why I Hate Being a Guy, you mentioned the feeling or that need, especially in college, to be a part of the boys, like to go out and drink with your friends, to do these things like that we would label like traditional, like traditionally masculine things. I want to ask, those traditionally masculine things, do you think that the almost requirement of guys to do those things, do you think that that may have had any impact in the future then for you? Because you mentioned like drinking and stuff like that. Do you think that that helped establish behavior patterns for you in the future? Or do you think that it was really just, I want to be one of the guys, this is what I have to do that?
Probably a combination of both, you know, just the question, you know, as society places, you know, certain parameters on femininity, certain parameters on masculinity. And some of it was wanting to be one of the guys. Some of it was also, you know, those feelings and dealing with pain and wanting to prove certain things. And, you know, it's kind of funny, but not. My wife said, if you're ever confused, this is what she says, just do this. And you won't be confused anymore. You're a man, John. And you don't ever have to prove anything to anybody. And even if you're a man attracted to other men, you're still a man. And the same for women. You never have to be confused about what gender you are. That's just me. And I know it's a big controversial thing nowadays, but I was born this way. I wasn't born to be raped. And, you know, sitting around, you know, and I'm a guy, you know, but guys comparing sizes and all these things that we hear about, and, you know, mine's bigger than yours and all of this social nonsense, you know, all you guys listening out there, if you're a guy and that's what you are, you're a guy, but you certainly don't have to play the social parameters and be something that you're not, or live by a standard that doesn't fit your core value sets. I've done things not physically and not really, but I've done things to girls that probably shouldn't have been done, being mean or lying to them. Oh yeah, I love you. And you know, and things that didn't line up with my core values. Who's to blame and why I did it? I don't know. there's nobody to blame but myself. I had to accept responsibility. But I would certainly say that some of that stuff is out of the ashes of sexual assault. I can't think of anything else that it would be, because by nature, I never want to hurt anybody.
Yeah.
Women are men. I'm not placed on this planet to cause trouble for people. And then I certainly, you know, I mean, I love people. I mean, I really do. And it's not the kind of love that the world embraces. It's more of a divine, deep devotion to humans. I think that every person on this planet has a right to be here. We never asked to be born. And I really believe all the cliches that everybody's got something that they can give. Mm-hmm. And for people that take advantage of people like, you know, like that kid did to me, I can't imagine the pain that he was in. What happened to him? Didn't make it right for what he did to me, but, you know, I had to turn that around and forgive and have some empathy and compassion, because being in 7 foster homes or whatever, I don't know what he experienced, but it obviously probably wasn't very good. Isn't it a fact that kids emulate things? I never wanted to experiment like that with anybody, even after it happened, you know, and I thank God for that. But yeah, these are tough issues, you know, these are tough things. And I, by no means an expert on sexual assault and what it does to the mind. I only have some experience and what it did to my mind, and what my event was like, you know, my episode.
Yeah. And hopefully anyone listening doesn't take my question as coming off, and hopefully you didn't either, John, as coming off as like kind of abrasive or just like assumptive. I don't even think that's a word, but I really want to ask. Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm glad the writer tells me it's a word. That means I can use it. But the main reason I wanted to ask that question specifically about traditionally masculine behaviors is because a lot of times when I'm doing presentations with men, it's, I have to do those things because that's what it means to be a man. I have to go out and drink. That's the only time I can show those emotions besides anger and aggression. And that's not the case. If you identify as a man, that makes you a man. That is the only thing you need. You don't need to go out and drink excessively. You don't need to sleep around and sleep with as many people as you want as possible. You don't have to do these quote unquote traditionally masculine things. As long as you're a man, you're a man. And the reason that I asked about the, if you think that that aided in your like future drinking and stuff, is because that's a common coping mechanism of people who have experienced sexual assault.
Especially with men. Men are so much more likely to have substance use problems or drinking problems because traditionally they don't get the help that they need at the age or experience when it happens. And so they develop those things as those coping mechanisms, especially like in your situation, John. I mean, you're a young boy, right? This has happened to you in the first place. And then the fact that it happened to you from another male, then you've got all of these things coming at you about non-traditional sex values and you don't know what to do with them. And so you've just developed this coping mechanism over life, PTSD, whatever's going on. It's the only way that you know how to deal with it, because traditionally men don't get help for those things.
That's true. So that's your all's expertise. And to go with Sean, you know, you're right, Sean, that if you're born that way, that's what you are, right? The choices that you make is what determines how you're going to react to these outside traumatic stimuli. And you all know the sexual ones are probably some of the hardest ones to deal with, because there's this euphoria, you know, love, but sex, you know, there's oxytocin involved with it and vasopressin and dopamine. And there's this excitement and there's this closeness and contact and skin on skin. And, you know, I don't want to get too, you know, visual here, but that there's confusion with that too. And you're right, Amanda, at a young age, young boy, young girl should not have to go through and deal with situations like that. It need not happen. And it did, you know, I can remember just, you know, being one of the boys and being stupid and guzzling beer and, oh, she's looking at me. And, you know, one night stands were not uncommon. I mean, I wasn't a male slut by any sense of the definition, but, you know, and then, oh my gosh, what did I do? You know, and it's not right. So then what happens is it snowballs and you feel worse about yourself because you start feeling that girl didn't deserve that. She, mm-hmm. I shouldn't have done that. You know, I shouldn't have told her that just to get what I want. I'm responsible, or I want to be, I don't want any skeletons hanging in my closet. You know, mm-hmm. I want to, you know, put it out there in the universe that I'm really totally sorry for anybody's heart who I ever broke. Doesn't make it right then, but maybe it makes it right now. And I just want to let anybody know who I've ever hurt, including my wife. She knows me well enough that I never meant any of it. And I take full responsibility, but there was a mitigating event, a single event that's caused a lot of trouble for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if we could affect people in a positive way at the global level? That's a different show.
Yeah. And it's one of the things that I've not been shy about mentioning on our podcast either. Like, as a man growing up in the United States, growing up with the values that we teach men specifically at a very young age, there have been people that I've harmed in my life too. Specifically, there have been women who I've been in relationships with, who I know I have harmed, who I've made feel uncomfortable. And I think that's one of the important pieces, is being able to recognize that. Is it doesn't make what I've done in the past acceptable, right? It doesn't disregard or negate any of the feelings that those people have, but it does give me the opportunity to work with other men and point out how the quote unquote traditionally masculine views that we have of going out and trying to sleep with as many people as possible, treating women like they're not our equals, there's inevitable outcomes to those, and those inevitable outcomes are doing harm. And unless we change the views that we have around women or how we view relationships as a whole, we are going to have men who continually still do harm. And I know it's not necessarily related to your story specifically, John, but I know that something that you've said that you would relate to is that you've mentioned that you've done harm. And that, like you said, it doesn't negate the harm, but being able to recognize that harm does make it so that, one, we're not going to do those things again, but it does give us the unique opportunity to put us in a position where men may listen to us and may change their behaviors or change their outlooks so they don't do those things in the future and do the harm that we have done.
That's such a great way of looking at it. You know, to me, and this is, I don't know, there's probably guys that are like this, but I always found working with women easier. Yeah. Because women are, to me, they're a blessing because they're so creative. And most of women that I know, professionals and just acquaintances and friends, they're they're in tune with part of their personalities that guys kind of box out. You know, like, we're not supposed to cry and we're not supposed to show love and compassion and all of these things. And so I always felt more comfortable around women. To me, men always wanted to compete. They always wanted to one up. And I'm a guy, so I don't want to be a hypocrite here, but at the same time, you're right. There are social parameters and constraints and beliefs that hurt both genders. You know, both of them, you know, women, you know, I've got to always look my best and, you know, I've got to have the 20-inch waist and, you know, they go through their own struggles.
Yeah.
And it's a shame that we just can't be who we are and be happy with who we are, and that we have to play by these social parameters that take us away from our spirits. Because everybody's got a spirit. And I just think that as the older I get, I just realize how much I don't know and how willing and open I am to learn and to learn about other people and to learn that my way is not the only way. And that there are people out there that are just phenomenal people waiting to find their calling, but they may be held back because of a trauma or because of what the social parameters might suggest. And those are things that I'm working on in my own personal life. I mentioned the TED Talk, you know, it's going to be on love and primarily how to express it and do it in a way that's positive for humanity. And maybe not necessarily the love that the world embraces, which is very topical and less meaningful in so many cases. You know, it's a spiritual thing, and humans are spiritual beings. And when we get disconnected, sometimes it's hard to get back. We hear a lot about plant medicine therapy, and you know, I learned a little bit about that. And these shamans say that when people are traumatized, their spirits, their souls get disconnected from the essence of who they are. And so we spend a lifetime trying to get back to who we are. And what these medicines do, these traditional ancient medicines that shamans have used forever, since the beginning of recorded time with pictures in caves, is they're trying to take people to a non-ego state, which, oh my gosh, that plays a big part in it too, to reconnect with who they are spiritually. And I know this isn't a show on religion, but there's a difference between religion and spirituality. Mm-hmm. And my own personal belief based on reading and how I feel is that we're living in a world now that's completely disconnected from the spirit. These global populations think we can control the supernatural, which is something we really can't explain. And we have the greatest technologies, but yet we still have people being raped. We still have hungry people. We still have so many global social issues. And you would think in the 21st century, with as much history as human beings have behind them, that we could do better. And so I applaud people like you, Sean and Amanda, for having a show like this, to have guys like me come on and just share some insights on how to improve their own lives. You all have opened up a platform here and a podcast show that is so badly needed in today's world that I'm just thrilled to death that people give me 45 minutes or an hour to help others. So you helping me to tell my story, you're helping others. And there might be somebody out there who's listening that we don't even know. We may never meet them. And they may say, hey, I heard something today. I'm going to start looking into that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And one of the things you were talking about, John, was, you know, those social constraints that we have about, you know, how you're supposed to act and how you're supposed to be and how we don't need to be that way. And the only way really that we see that we can end that is by talking about those things, which is why we do these kinds of shows. We want to talk about them. We want to get it out there. We want people to know that this isn't something that they need to keep hidden. They don't need to be ashamed about what happened to them. It's not their fault for what happened to them, but that doesn't mean they can't take responsibility for what goes on later in their life either. But just being out there, talking, getting it into the open air and not have it be one of those hidden under the rug kind of issues anymore.
You know, no, Amanda, you're 110% right. And what I tried to do in my therapy was to get back to my core value sets. And what I wrote them down, but I got them down to single words. And if people can reflect and do some introspection and some work and determine and decide what their core values are and live by them, then your life can be better and more fulfilling. And so my core value words that I came up with was leadership, love, recognition, teamwork, calling, liberty, and humanity. And those words mean different things to different people. But to me, that's what I try to get back to. And I always tell people, if you ever make a mistake in your life, for whatever reason, forgive yourself and move on. And if it went against your core value sets, just find a way to get back there. You have a choice and you can do it. We can only help each other, and humanity is only going to get better if we have shows like this, and then we can trade stories to let people know that they're not alone, and that there is a way out, a way to make things better. You know, when you live in a world where 85% of the people say they're not happy, how could you not be happy in the 21st century? Mm-hmm. We've got so many things at our fingertips that there's opportunities out there for everybody. It might be more difficult for some people in some places, but there's always choices. I refuse to give up. I make a conscious effort every day to keep going. Is life easy? It is if you decide it is. But for the most part, we're very blessed to even have the air that we breathe. We hear so much about gratitude and what people's modus operandi are, their programs and the things that they do. And we talk about gratitude, but gratitude really works if you believe it. If you're going through the motions, then it may not work, or it may take a while to get there. But I believe that every human being has a calling. Every human being wants to be accepted for who they are, regardless if they're a man or a woman, what they look like, what nationality they are, what color their skin. It doesn't matter any of that. That's just fodder for sensationalism. What matters is the person. And you deserve to be here. You belong here. And I'm saying that rhetorically, because that's the way the universe wants it. So what are you going to do with your life? How are you going to turn it around to not only live your life's calling, the purpose that the universe has for you? And it's not woo-woo. This is real. If you're not happy in your life, figure it out. Take responsibility and move on. Look for people, listen to shows, find a way out, because you deserve a good life.
Other things you said with that, John, earlier was that, I don't remember exactly how you phrased it, but basically what comes to mind is it takes a village. And I don't remember if that's the word you used or not, but you know, people have to know that they don't have to go through this on their own. It's not something that you should just be expected to be able to overcome. That's why there are people out there who do the work that they do, counselors, therapists, whatever, and to be able to just take that step and ask for some help.
No, you're again, 110% right on that one too, because you know, I have in one of my slides or one of my presentations for, you know, removing the blindfold, it's called amigos and amigas. And, you know, your friends, and you know who they are, but it's not just your friends too. It is a professional network. If there are professionals out there, like that young person who was on, you can tell by the voice, but the young lady who was on the phone, I'm putting it out in the universe. She literally was part of saving my life. And she's working a suicide hotline. So she's had to talk to some pretty interesting people. And I just thank her for that. And that's part of that network. So if you're in a not so good place, who can you call besides a hotline or a therapist? Call the people that you know you can count on and trust. We've all got at least one friend on this planet that would listen.
And John, I want to ask one more question before we kind of wrap everything up here. But in your story, do you think, if we're trying to figure out how we can make our society and our communities a bit better, what could have been there, or what could have been available to you, do you think, that may have helped you out a lot sooner?
Great question. You know, I think, and looking back on now, of course, this is the early 70s that this happened, right? So things were a lot different then. You know, I remember 10-cent telephone calls. We didn't have computers. We didn't have any of this. And, you know, 15-cent hamburgers at McDonald's. So I'm aging myself here. But I, you know, if there was some kind of, it would be great if you could somehow get to the parents if somehow the people that operated in your professional circles could reach out to parents in a constructive way, because my parents were absolutely, and God bless them, my dad's gone, I love my mom, but they didn't see anything. You know, they were completely brain dead. And all you have to do is look at the cover of my book. You don't have to be an expert on emotional trauma, but you can see there's a problem with that child. And when that child is in high school, lashing out, being rebellious, you know, there's a certain amount of that growing up and drinking, you know, at 15 and 16 years old, there's a reason for it, you know? So if anything could have been better, my parents could have been better educated on signs and symptoms of sexual trauma, because that could have saved me. And I don't blame anybody, it's just the way it was, but that could have saved me and the others who I hurt, and I admit that, a lot of trouble. You don't know what the outcome would have been, but I could have maybe been taught the skill sets earlier to handle the triggers of sexual assault.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I ask is because it's one thing hearing it from people like Amanda and myself saying like, hey, we need to be able to do these things, or we need to have access to these things, or we need these things in place to be able to help victims or to prevent other people from becoming victims or survivors in the future. But it's another thing to hear it from someone who is an expert in their own story, who knows what would have helped them. And it really hits the point home more that while, yes, we're experts, quote unquote experts, in what we're doing, there's always going to be a need for people advocating for those things. And it can't just be from the mouths of survivors, because that's exhausting for them.
Well, imagine that we get off this call today, and Amanda and you get with Allie and you ask, how can we write a curriculum or a workshop for parents? The signs and symptoms of trauma. You know, I mean, I didn't mean to cut you off, but imagine if you all from this one show, I'm sure you all thought about it, but if you could come up with an online program for parents, these are the things that, you know, you're 15 years old, is that sneaking out of the window drinking at night. Some of that's rebelliousness, but I will bet you when it's habitual, there's something else going on. But so you're right.
Yeah. And so those of you that are listening, if you're not a survivor or a victim of sexual assault or domestic violence, if you're an expert in the field of work that Amanda and I are doing, this is something that you can do. You can help us and help survivors and victims advocate for these things. Because if we have people who aren't in our field and we are not relying solely on survivors and victims to be the ones advocating for these changes or these things to happen, it makes it a lot more easy for us to be able to do those things and to be able to get out into our communities and work on making our communities a better place.
Yeah.
So again, John, I want to thank you so much for being here. It's the second time that I've heard your story now, and both times I always end up tearing up towards the end there. So,
well, I don't mean to bring tears, but tears can be a good thing, but
don't worry. They're not tears of sadness. It's just,
thank you for the opportunity. And again, I don't say this lightly, how important it is that you all keep this show going and allow people like myself to at least share. Because when we finally realize that we're not alone, it makes a huge difference. But it does take work. There's nothing to sugarcoat when it comes to PTSD, like Amanda mentioned. And there's nothing, you know, in society that we still have to go out there with those parameters. But be leaders, you know, be brave, be courageous, be you. And sometimes the hardest, biggest challenge that we have as humans is to accept who we are, to love who we are, to live the life that we're meant to have. Don't let sexual assault, sexual trauma ruin it. Just don't do it. You know, make the choice to live your life, and you can start right now.
So again, thank you, John. Do you have anything you want to plug? Because I know you have some books.
But I'm here for your listeners. You can look me up, John Krotek, johntkrotek.com, johntkrotec.com. I have a company called Green Zone Hero, greenzonehero.com. I also, we just kickstarted hashtag planet.co, which is helping nonprofits take care of some of their missions. And then I'm working on the TED Talk about love. It's called Love Doesn't Hurt, It Heals. And it's based on the Nazareth song, Remember Love Hurts. Check out that song. Look at that song on YouTube. But that, no, so just thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thank you, listeners, for tuning into this podcast show, because it means a lot to the people that are doing it, to Sean and Amanda and Allie who couldn't make it. And it means a lot to me. So thank you for listening.
And John, when you have that TED Talk up and running, please let us know, and we will be more than happy to share it with our listeners on our socials. And speaking of socials, thank you all for listening today. Please feel free to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Touchy Subs Pod. Please feel free to email us any questions, comments, or concerns to touchysubjectspodcast@gmail.com.
And in the meantime, don't be afraid to challenge, ask, and discuss when it comes to touchy subjects.